Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg made his debate stage debut last night in Nevada. Here's how he introduced himself to the nation.
I'm a New Yorker. I know how to take on an arrogant con man like Donald Trump that comes from New York.
Bloomberg has been rising in the polls and was the frequent target of attacks by the rest of the candidates on the stage. Here we go.
Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
Let's put forward somebody who actually lives and works in a middle-class neighborhood in an industrial Midwestern city. Let's put forward somebody who's actually a Democrat.
And that's just a small sampling. We're talking national politics today with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, welcome back, Ken.
Hey, my goodness.
Yes. I saw that you opined about halfway through last night. You were not happy with the tenor of the debate?
Well, it's not that I was not happy. It's not that I had a rooting interest or anything like that. It just seemed like there was just such venom and personal stuff and sniping that, you know, I usually complain that the moderators, the debate moderators, interfere too often, that they don't let the candidates go at it. But this time, I think the moderators went out and caught a movie somewhere because they were hardly involved in the thing. They let them go after each other, which is fine. But at some point, look, this is a debate. This is not a, it should be back and forth. It should be lively, and it certainly was lively. It just got a little tiring and exhausting, shall we say.
What was the deal with them raising their hands all the time? I wasn't sure about what the rules were.
Well, the rules are actually, that's interesting you say that, because usually when a candidate is talking and he or she mentions a rival, usually they'll raise their hand. They want to be called on next. But what's interesting is that before she was even called on, Elizabeth Warren had planned what she wanted to say about Michael Bloomberg and let him have it. I mean, she was probably the most effective attacker on Bloomberg. Look, Bloomberg, I mean, there's a lot of resentment about Michael Bloomberg, even though Bernie Sanders is the ostensible front runner. You know, he did very well in Iowa and New Hampshire. He could very well win in Nevada on Saturday. And yet the attacks were not on the front. And he's also leading in the national polls, some by big margins. And yet the attacks were not on the so-called front runner. It was this interloper who was spending, Michael Bloomberg, who's spending close to $400 million on commercials. And a lot of candidates, one, don't like the fact that he's trying to buy the nomination. And two, if you're a centrist, moderate, so-called moderate centrist candidate, like Pete Buttigieg, like Amy Klobuchar, like Joe Biden, you don't want to be squeezed out by another centrist who has deep pockets. So that accounts for all the attacks on Bloomberg.
Amy Klobuchar remarked that she was willing to welcome him to the fray until she found out that he was saying that two or three of them should just get out of the race.
Well, look, Michael Bloomberg's argument, first of all, I think his commercials, which are omnipresent, I mean, they're everywhere, and you can't turn on a TV without seeing Michael Bloomberg commercial. I think his commercials are very effective, but he knows that if he's going to take on Bernie Sanders, who, you know, is very strong in the polls and has a very strong amount of support from his supporters, if he's going to be the guy to take him on, he can't share the stage with fellow centrists like Biden and Buttigieg and Klobuchar. So Amy Klobuchar is among those who resents the fact that Bloomberg's trying to push her out. Now, every time I watch a debate, I always come away saying, boy, that Amy Klobuchar was really, really good. I'm surprised she doesn't do better in the polls.
Uh-huh.
In the previous debate, she did very well, and she did a surprisingly strong third in New Hampshire. But last night, I thought she seemed sputtering almost and flustered and almost like when she would respond to a Buttigieg charge, she would, it almost seemed juvenile, which, you know, I mean, look, you know, I'm not the one to talk about who's the most adult-like there, but I thought she didn't do herself much good.
Things turned kind of bitter between Buttigieg and Klobuchar when they started sparring over immigration policy, and then there was a recent gaffe where she had failed to recall the name of Mexico's president during an interview, unfortunately for her, on Telemundo. Let's listen.
Yes, we've got to wake up as a party. We could wake up 2 weeks from today, the day after Super Tuesday, and the only candidates left standing will be Bernie Sanders and Mike Bloomberg, the two most polarizing figures on this stage.
Okay, that was not their cut. Let's do the cut now.
You're on the committee that oversees border security. You're on the committee that does trade. You're literally in part of the committee that's overseeing these things. And we're not able to speak to literally the first thing about the politics of the country to ourselves.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb, or are you mocking me here, Pete?
This is a race for president.
Yeah, I mean, it went on from there and got pretty tense. It felt like it was a personality clash at that point and not really one of substance.
Exactly. And then at one point she says to him and says, well, I'm sorry that we can't all be as perfect as you, Pete.
Yeah.
That just didn't seem like the way to respond. And as I say, I usually come away with from the debates saying that she was really very good. She mixes. She has a good ability to combine humor with personal and personality, should I say. But this time it seemed more petulant than anything else.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking national politics with Ken Rudin, host of the Ken Rudin Political Junkie podcast. Of course, we welcome your insights and calls. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Okay, so the burning question, of course, is how did Mike Bloomberg do? How do you think that he did for his first time on the hot seat?
You're asking me how I felt about Bloomberg?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was a disaster. I mean, the fact that he seemed, look, for one thing, he has not been in a debate since 2009, mm-hmm. when he was running for a third term as mayor of New York, and there was no question that he was going to win. But he just seemed, look, you knew the attacks were coming. You had to have known the attacks were coming, because if you looked at any newspaper in the past 2 or 3 weeks, it was all about Michael Bloomberg's positions on stop and frisk, which he instituted when he was mayor of New York City and still defended it as recently as 2015. You know about his crude and demeaning comments he's made about women in the past. You know his comments about redlining and how they affect African Americans and Latinos and the poor. I mean, there's a whole litany of things that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party could go after him. And he just seemed like, well, like when Elizabeth Warren was getting on him about these non-disclosure agreements, mm-hmm. with women who complained about harassment at Bloomberg companies, not Bloomberg personally, but his companies, mm-hmm. he said, well, you know, it takes two to agree to untangle themselves from these non-disclosure agreements. And it just didn't sound right. Now, of course, there's another debate coming up Tuesday, yeah. in South Carolina, in the days prior, leading up to the South Carolina primary on the 29th. And maybe he'll do better. But you know something, you would know this better than anyone, Ann, when you have billions of dollars and you have, and you know, you're always told that you are always right, sometimes you're not prepared for criticism. And boy, did he get criticism.
Yeah.
By the way, I know what they're paying you at WOSU. Don't laugh away. Don't laugh away my comments. I know exactly what's going on there.
I feel his pain. it was interesting. I think, the first miscast cut there of Buttigieg talking about the prospects of sending two of the most polarizing figures on the stage to a general election against Donald Trump, neither of whom are what he said are actually a Democrat, seemed to be a shot between the eyes as well.
Yeah, well, actually, I really thought his attack on the not really a Democrat was more on Sanders, because, you know, I'm surprised nobody's even mentioned this in a debate, but Sanders has spent his whole career battling both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. He is an independent. He calls himself a socialist. His beginning of his career in Vermont, he was a member of the Liberty Union Party, which was very left-wing, you know, very progressive left-wing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I mean, silly things like like, well, the fact that Bernie Sanders spent his honeymoon in the Soviet Union. Now, I sound like I'm from the 1950s red baiting, but these are issues that you kind of think that the that the Trump campaign are going to jump all over should Bernie Sanders be the nominee. But at the same time, I don't think there's any candidate among everybody who was on stage who brings out the passion of supporters than Bernie Sanders. He has millions of donors, small donors. He has raised the most money, the most online supporters. This is a quandary for the Democratic Party, whether you pick the most ideologically pure candidate or you pick somebody who can beat Donald Trump. And right now, the party is divided over that.
I saw a political cartoon. I wish I could remember the name of the cartoonist, but it was a Bernie 2020 sign, and it said at the bottom, paid for by the Republican National Committee.
Well, that's a little harsh, but I did tweet, I think I tweeted yesterday that Donald Trump, by executive order, mandated that the debate be extended for one more hour last night. Because basically, aside from Michael Bloomberg being the clear loser last night, I think the clear winner may have been Donald Trump.
Yes, I heard that he had it on Air Force One or something like that, and had for the media.
He was hoping everybody would be watching. Yeah. Well, why focus on his misdeeds and the things and the pardons and everything else he's doing? Let's focus on those dangerous Democrats. And what's fascinating to me about it is that for the first eight debates, the Democrats were focused on Donald Trump and the 3 years of his presidency and everything that he's done wrong. Of course, he's done things right, but they're not going to talk about that. But the things he's done wrong. And yet there was nary a word about Trump. I mean, about Trump. Maybe Bloomberg mentioned a few times. Mm-hmm. And of course, Bernie Sanders will always say that he's a racist and a misogynist and the worst president in history. But for most part, it was a circular firing squad last night.
Right. What do you make of that? I mean, we expected the attacks on Bloomberg. That wasn't a surprise, but I was surprised. I mean, there were a few times, you know, Elizabeth Warren would say, listen, I'm going to support whoever gets the nomination, but a lot of buts there.
You know something? I wonder about that. I especially, every time you criticize Bernie Sanders supporters, they will tear you apart on social media. But they still feel, for a good portion of them, still feel that mm-hmm. the 2016 election or the nominating process was rigged. They feel that the DNC had the thumb on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton. And they're determined to make sure that doesn't happen again. But, you know, like, for example, when the Culinary Union in Nevada mm-hmm. decided not to endorse anybody and, in fact, criticized Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan, his supporters sent vicious and cruel and personal and threatening messages to the head of the union. And Bernie Sanders said, look, that's just a few. I have millions of supporters. You can't hold me responsible for the acts of some very few. But Buttigieg says, look, you know, you inspire this. And, you know, there's something to be said about that. So I just wonder if they're, for all the talk about unity, whether if Bernie is the nominee, whether his supporters, his opponents will support him. And if he's not the nominee, whether his supporters will back that nominee.
Right.
Still a long way to go, but last night was not a good sign for Democratic Party unity.
We are talking national politics with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're kind of mopping up today after the most recent Democratic presidential primary debate last night. My guest is Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Questions or comments for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about former Vice President Joe Biden. He needed a big night. If he had any hope of reclaiming that frontrunner status, he's really counting on South Carolina. How did he do?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because during the break, I was just thinking about him. The fact is that he was the ostensible frontrunner for the longest time, based on his 8 years, based on his name ID, of course, and his 8 years as the loyal vice president under Barack Obama. But he has watched Michael Bloomberg siphon away much of his support, as Joe Biden did poorly in Iowa and New Hampshire with fourth and fifth place finishes. He's not expected to win in Nevada. He's got to win in South Carolina. That was always his firewall state. That primary is February 29th on a Saturday. There's a large African-American population there. 60% of the Democratic electorate there is African-American. Biden was always counting on that support. But as his numbers have shrunken in the last couple of weeks, his black support is decreased as well. Tom Steyer, who was not on the debate stage last night, is making a very expensive effort in both Nevada and South Carolina. And a lot of his support, as I said, is going to Michael Bloomberg. So when Joe Biden sees ads from Michael Bloomberg saying, you hear him saying, Barack Obama saying that Michael Bloomberg did a great job as mayor.
Yeah.
Biden has to be livid about that. And so, to the best of his ability, he also went after Bloomberg for stop and frisk stuff and things like that. But I still have not seen, some people disagree with this, but I have never seen a great Biden debate performance. I just feel that he has things to say and he just doesn't get it out as clearly and as smoothly as a Buttigieg or a Warren or a Sanders, for example. So there is that, but I don't want to write off any candidate. That's not our job, and it shouldn't be our job. But even whatever he does in Nevada, if he doesn't win in South Carolina, and right now he's still leading in the polls, it's hard to make the case that support will all flock, won't flock to Michael Bloomberg.
Let's see, Gail in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Gail. Hello, Gail.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Okay. Well, I have a couple things to say. One is, I didn't think that Bloomberg was a disaster. In fact, I rather appreciated that he stayed out of what was kind of a cat and dog fight at points. And it seemed to me, and I agree that the first time he spoke, he was a little bit tentative, and you did get the impression it had been a while since he debated. But after that, when he did enter, it seemed to me he sounded knowledgeable and worth listening to. And that it wasn't just a matter of throwing personal comments back and forth. And later, another point, when Buttigieg was saying, you put up Sanders and Bloomberg, you have a cat and dog, or you have the most polarizing people to vote between. Actually, what's going to happen if Bernie Sanders, who I do admire in many ways, if he turns out to be the nominee for the party, you will have the two most polarizing people in America to vote between come November. Hmm. At any rate, I'm just saying that, back to the first point, that I really quite appreciated Mayor Bloomberg, although I do see he's going to be getting trouble on that question about releasing the sealed depositions or whatever they were from the women, or their sealed agreement. Hmm. Anyhow, that's all. Thanks
all right.
So much, Anne.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
You bet, Gail. Ken Rudin?
Oh, I like a lot of what Gail had to say. It's interesting, the thought of, in her words and Buttigieg's words, that if the choice in November is between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, the two most polarizing people in America, that's exactly what they said in 2016, that the polls show that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were the two most polarizing people ever to be the presidential nominees of their party. But I agree with Gail on one point. I think that Bloomberg got stronger as he went on. I think he was flummoxed in the beginning because basically he didn't even have time to exhale. They went after him so quickly, both Warren and Sanders, that he was just almost, just not prepared. But again, if you're a debater, if you're in the political arena, you should be more prepared than he was. And to say, you know, about the non-disclosure agreements, well, we'll see what happens with that. And to say that, yes, I did make, he said when one of the women, when there was a reference to some of the women's complaints, he said, well, maybe they didn't like a joke I said. That was, I think, dismissing, I think, a bigger issue there. But also the fact about stop and frisk. And look, I understand what he was trying to say, that New York was in big, big trouble when he took over as mayor in 2001 after 8 years of Rudy Giuliani. It was in big trouble, and he did what he thought would stop the crime. But you don't rip up the Constitution. You don't take away people's constitutional rights just because you're, you know, obsessed about or fearful of crime. And that's what basically he did. And the fact that he was still defending stop and frisk as recently as 2015, tape just came out on that.
Yep.
It just hurts his cause. I will agree with Gail. Look, I think his commercials are very, very effective. I know they get under Trump's skin and they're the best of any candidate by far. But if he is going to be the nominee, he's going to have to win over a lot of those progressives who have not forgotten his record on women and minorities and stop and frisk and things like that. It's going to be a tough, but a bigger question, and maybe this leads to Gail's point as well, is that I think far more people will be watching his commercials than people who tuned into the debate. And if that's the case, then I could only see that Bloomberg continuing to rise in the polls.
It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We're talking national politics today. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kim.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have two things. One is I don't recall anybody mentioning African-American women last night. And we'll point out that NBC didn't bring a moderator fitting that demographic. Was I wrong about that?
Nope.
Well,
I agree with you. I did.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, he's African American, but yeah.
African American women. No, yeah, I agree exactly. With Kim on that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we always are talking about that's the most important demographic, but there's no representation in the moderation, and it doesn't come up in a question. So that's one.
Okay.
The other is, Ken, I'd like to take exception to the kind of framing of Bernie's supporters or the people he claims are not his supporters as them feeling slighted. This is the same behavior that we experienced as women online, certainly as African-American women online, from Bernie Bros. They were racist and misogynist and violent then. It's not isolated. This is a continuing issue, and I don't want the framing of that. Well, they feel slighted. Bernie's not a Democrat, okay? So if they object to how the Democratic Party treats Bernie, create their own party.
Ken Rudin.
Well, two things. These are important issues, and let me just raise it quickly. One, there is, you know, South Carolina is going to be the first state where there is a sizable black turnout expected, 60% in the Democratic primary. There's a debate on CBS next Tuesday from Charleston, South Carolina. If there is not an African-American woman on that panel, that was shame on CBS for that. That's definitely the truth. But as far as the Bernie brothers, I am not excusing their behavior at all, because what they've done, they did this also in Nevada in 2016. They felt that the election was stolen from them. For example, Bernie Sanders won big in New Hampshire in 2016, but Hillary Clinton got just as many delegates because of the superdelegates. There are a lot of grievances that the Bernie people had in 2016 and continues today. Having said that, the response to some of the officials, like, for example, in Nevada, there was a female chair of the Nevada Democratic Party in 2016 who received death threats and words that I would have never even say to myself, let alone say on the air, from these Bernie supporters. Now, people say, well, you know, something that's only a small percentage, and that may be the case, but I don't know any candidate, certainly on the Democratic side, any candidate supporters who have done the kind of things, said the kind of things, and reacted the kind of way that they have. And I, maybe I'll get slammed for that as well, because I'm not criticizing, you know, the fact is I'm trying to be very careful here, and I'm not trying to label every Bernie Sanders supporter as a hate-filled zealot, but there's more of that. Facts show that. There are more of that on the Bernie Sanders side. Oh, I'm going to get myself in trouble for saying this, but more on the Bernie Sanders side than for other candidates.
I've been informed that Gayle King is on the panel next Tuesday.
Very good. Good panel. For Jackie. Thank you for checking.
You bet.
That.
Yeah. Thanks to Herb for doing that. Kim, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. I've got a Facebook comment from James who says, Democrats need to stop looking to elect Snow White or Mr. Rogers. That's a recipe for losing. It kind of goes to the comment that Bloomberg made at the outset that he's a New Yorker who can fight another New Yorker. And then, of course, his criticisms of Donald Trump. But what do you think about that, Ken?
Well, I don't know exactly what James is saying. I mean, who is somebody, Snow White and Mr.
Well, somebody who'll get down in the dirt, I think he's saying. They gotta nominate a fighter.
Well, I mean, if you want a fighter, there are a lot of different fighters on there. I saw a fighting Bernie Sanders, who always fights. For somebody who, let's face it, you know, is 78 years old and had a heart attack last October, he seems to be the most vigorous of all the candidates. He's filled with fury, and he's certainly a fighter. I don't know if we want a wrestling match in the debates against Donald Trump, but also at the same time, you don't want somebody to sit back and say, well, on the other hand, I mean, I keep thinking of how Hillary Clinton should have handled him during the debate. And while I thought Hillary Clinton won all the debates, she let him do things that probably maybe a man wouldn't have done. I think she was, I don't know if she was intimidated by him or she felt that people would attack her for being a sensitive woman. I mean, I don't even know what the argument was against Hillary Clinton, but during the debate. But I think you need somebody. It's going to be an ugly campaign. We know that for a fact. We know that what Trump has done to Joe Biden so far, which is one of the reasons Joe Biden has declined in the polls, not to put the blame on anybody else, but you do need a fighter. And I think almost everybody on that stage last night showed a lot of spunk and the ability to fight. And if you look at Bloomberg's commercials, they're certainly fighting too, because he responds as strong against Trump as anybody as I've seen.
An email from Dell says that Senator Bernie Sanders says that the candidate who shows up in Milwaukee with the most pledged delegates, even if not a majority, should be the nominee. Is this a recipe for failure? Says, P.S. more Ken Rudin, please.
Actually, I wrote that. I put his name on it, but I really wrote that. No, thank you for that. But look, the rules say that you need a majority. You need 1,981 delegates to get nominated. For Bernie Sanders to say, well, you know, whoever's leading at the end of the day on the first ballot should be the nominee. That's not what the rules are. And so for Bernie Sanders to say that when his supporters have been complaining about possible changing of the rules in the past, that's kind of disingenuous as far as the way I see it. I mean, the fact is, what Bernie Sanders is most afraid of, and it's probably a legitimate fear, is that if no candidate has a majority of the delegates at the end of the first ballot, then on the second ballot, those nefarious superdelegates can vote. Those are the superdelegates who are governors and senators and congressmen and elected officials of the party. They, in the past, they were created to keep the party from nominating another George McGovern, somebody who you know, excited some people, but wound up losing 49 states to Richard Nixon. They needed the adults in the room. That's why these superdelegates were created. But the Bernie people say, with some justification, that they are an establishment. They don't think outside the box. And they will back the safest candidate. On the other hand, they could also say that they will back somebody who they feel has the best chance of winning. So they know that if it goes to a second ballot, and by the way, no Democratic convention has gone past the first ballot since 1952, when Adlai Stevenson was the governor of Illinois. He walked into the convention in Chicago as a non-candidate and walked out as the nominee. So, I mean, you know, stranger things have happened, but not lately. But if it goes to a second ballot, the superdelegates will have a say, and I would think that's not good news for Bernie Sanders. That's why he says, if I'm leading after the first ballot, I should be the nominee.
And the other candidate said, yeah, no, not so much. Just let the process play out.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's what the rules are. And that's what Bloomberg said, too. The rules say you need a majority, and that's the way it should be.
You know, speaking of rules, I can't remember if we have talked since the Iowa caucuses.
Well, they're still counting in Iowa. I think Marianne Williamson has just moved into the lead there. Boy, that is, you know, talk
wow.
about. First of all, in 2012, they called Mitt Romney the winner, and then 3 weeks later, on the Republican side, they said, "Oops, we realized Rick Santorum got the win." And then last time, there in 2016, there's also disputes over the Bernie versus Hillary numbers. Iowa has not. It's hard to make the case that Iowa deserves to lead off after two, now three failures in a row. And I'm thinking if Nevada does well on Tuesday or even South Carolina, I like these states because it's not only just lily white, but it's more of America. It's more union. It's more people of color. It's Hispanics and it's African-Americans and seniors and things like that. So, boy, Iowa didn't absolve itself pretty well, and we'll see what happens in Nevada because they have the possibility of failure as well, but they don't have the same apps.
Right. And just the idea of a caucus, they're so rare, a lot of people don't understand why would they have them anyways. What's the benefit of a caucus?
Well, I'm not a fan of caucuses. I've been to one, and it's fascinating, but let's say you have children issues that you have to watch your children at night, or you work at night, and you want to spend commit to three, four, five hours debating issues while voting for candidates. I mean, first, and also the participation in caucuses is far less than what it is in primaries. I want the most people as possible to participate. I think whatever your vote, no matter who you vote for, you need to get out and vote. And caucuses reward the committed, the more ideologically committed candidates, the more impassioned voters. But if it means, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours of a commitment, if it means that fewer people get out to vote, I say scrap and just, I mean, Iowa's not going to be happy with that kind of comment from me, but look at what happened this year. It just go in, cast your ballot, and and assuming Russia is not, doctoring the votes, let the chips fall that way.
What do they do, just real quick before we take a break, what do they do with other down ticket issues or candidates or races in the primary season? Do they have regular primaries for those kind of things?
Well, it depends on the state. For example, when Ohio votes on March 17th, it will not only be for president, but it'll also be for Congress.
Yeah.
But for example, in Iowa and New Hampshire, a New Hampshire primary isn't until September. That's when you're going to vote for governor and senator and Congress.
Oh, okay.
They have two different things.
Huh.
Different states do it different ways.
We will be right back. We're talking national politics with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have folks who still want to talk about the, more of the presidential politics, but I also want to talk about the president real quick, Ken Rudin. The President Trump pardoned or commuted the sentences of nearly a dozen criminals on Tuesday, including Rod Blagojevich. And I'm so glad because I get to say his name. The impeached former Democratic governor of Illinois, of course, Michael Milken, the former junk bond king, and Edward DeBartolo, former owner of the San Francisco 49ers. There's questions
about Bernie Kerik.
Yeah, right. Bernie Kerik. And there's questions about whether, you know, who's next. His old friends, people think that, you know, there's a lot of questions about, for instance, the Blagojevich pardon and what went on there, Blagojevich being a Democrat. What do you make of what's going on right now?
Well, after all, though, you know, on the day that all this happened, the Blagojevich commutation, of course, of his sentence, Blagojevich now calls him he calls himself a Trumpocrat. No, he's not a Democrat anymore. He's a Trumpocrat. After Blagojevich's sentence was commuted and Michael Milken and Bernie Kerik, they asked him about Roger Stone, whose sentencing, I think, is scheduled for today.
Right.
Amy Berman Jackson is scheduled to hand down a sentence today. And they asked him, well, is Roger Stone next? And Trump said, well, you know, to be honest, I haven't even thought about it. I mean, that is such a crock. I mean,
of course.
I mean, that is so not true. Of course he thought about it. And I would suspect that no matter what happens to Roger Stone, a pardon is likely, as well as Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor. This is not, you know, I don't know how this comports with draining the swamp, because I think he's filling the swamp with these people who basically did horrific things. I mean, Michael Milken, my God, the billions of dollars of losses he's responsible with the junk bond frauds. Mm-hmm. Blagojevich not only tried to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat to the highest bidder. Now, of course, Trump said, well, he didn't sell the seat. Well, of course he didn't sell the seat because he was caught. I mean, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he also tried to extort the CEO of a children's hospital. It's so ugly. And he says, well, you know, people tell me, I get advice from other people. Bernie Kerik, who pleaded guilty to so many counts of felonies, but he's Rudy Giuliani is one of his closest friends. So there's so many things that, for all the talk about draining the swamp and changing the culture of Washington, well, look, what am I saying? I mean, I've been saying this for 3 years, and nothing changes, and especially when you look at William Barr, who, you know, tells the president, would you please stop tweeting? You're making my job more and more difficult. And Trump says, well, that's true. I am making your job more difficult, and keeps tweeting.
Yeah.
He keeps tweeting, criticizing prosecutors and the Justice Department. He's criticizing. He says, clean up the Justice Department, he says. So Barr, look, do I think that Barr seriously is considering quitting? No. Do I think he should? That's up to him. But my goodness, you know, there are very few Mitt Romneys who will stand up for your political, you know, very few Mitt Romneys in the Republican Party who will stand up for what you believe and take the risks, whatever they may be. Mitt Romney went home to Utah last week and basically he got hammered. You know, there are some, I mean, he's not going to be recalled from office, and Donald Trump said he should be impeached. You can't impeach a senator, but that doesn't stop Donald Trump from saying that. But Mitt Romney is taking heat from Republicans back in Utah. Now, he's not up for re-election until 2024, but Romney stood up for what he believed in, and he was the only one in the entire Senate of 53 Republicans.
Mark in Chillicothe, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Maybe this is a perfect moment for my question, which relates to the Republicans. And I'm wondering, Ken, what you think about the failure of former Governor Bill Weld to generate any substantial support at all among his party, and to do so miserably in the neighboring state of New Hampshire last week.
Well, a lot of thoughts on that. Usually, you're absolutely right. When you come by, you come from a neighboring state, and you're in the New Hampshire primary, you usually do well. I mean, my favorite example is Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the former senator from Massachusetts. When he won the I love this history. When he won the 1964 New Hampshire primary, he was the ambassador to South Vietnam. He was 3,000 miles away or 5,000 miles away, and he won it. So once upon a time, it mattered. But look, Bill Weld has a lot of strikes against him. One, he's a liberal, pro-choice Republican, and the Republican Party is hardly liberal or pro-choice anymore. Two, in 2016, he was the Libertarian Party candidate for vice president, and he bolted the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. You can make the case that he's not truly a Republican, even though he served two terms as a very popular governor of Massachusetts. But most importantly, that whatever you think of Donald Trump, the Republican Party is still crazy about him. This is Donald Trump's party. This right. is not, you know, Mitt Romney and John McCain had doubters within the party when they were the nominees, as were the two Bushes. But Donald Trump, he demands and gets and expects loyalty from everybody. If you say a good word about him, you're besieged by Trump tweets. And you're challenged in the next primary by an even more conservative Republican. So Weld may not have been the perfect vehicle to show opposition. I thought Mark Sanford, the former governor of South Carolina, would have been interesting, but he also dropped out. Joe Walsh, the former congressman from Illinois, dropped out. Weld is continuing to, you know, picks up endorsements now and then. Christy Whitman, the former liberal governor of New Jersey, a Republican, endorsed him. He's picking up. I think Charlie Baker, maybe the governor of Massachusetts, endorsed him, but nobody's going to take the nomination away from him, and nobody's going to get more than the 8 or 9% that Weld got in the primary, and especially in New Hampshire, next door neighbor. Hmm.
Thank you, Mark, for that call. Let's see. Pam in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Pam.
Good morning, and I want to congratulate both of you. I think you do a wonderful job of what you do, and Ken, you really have a feel of the psychological forces behind these elections. My comment is, I think a lot of Republicans are going to, again, hold their nose and vote for Trump. I'm hoping that most Democrats are going to do what Elizabeth Warren did and coalesce around whoever the nominee is, because they far outshine the person in the White House, no matter which one of them was up on stage last night, even some that weren't on stage. But my question is, how does the Democratic nominee, I think, and I see in polls, very close, most Democrats are slightly leading Trump in the current polls by just a couple percentage points. It looks like the independents are going to be the ones that are going to make the difference. And someone mentioned African-American women. I know they tend to vote Democratic, but I think that's a demographic they really are going to have to focus on getting out minorities and young people and African-American women. But how else can they appeal to the independents, many of whom were voted for Obama and then voted for Trump? Hmm.
Ken?
Well, that was one of the arguments that Michael Bloomberg was making, that he could appeal to those moderates, centrist independents, and even some disaffected Republicans, because after all, I mean, he was accused of being a Republican last night on the stage. And yes, he was elected as a Republican mayor of New York. But the only reason he became a Republican was because he had no chance of winning the Democratic nomination when he ran. So he became a Republican at a convenience. The fact is that, I mean, you think that maybe that's the kind of Democrat who could win centrist votes and independent votes. But at the same time, if you're so centrist and you're Trump light, then a lot of progressives will say, well, you know, there's no difference, and I'm gonna vote for Jill Stein or Tulsi Gabbard, who I'm pretty much convinced is going to run as a third party candidate, because she spends more time attacking Democrats and the DNC and appearing on Fox News than she is attacking Donald Trump. So I kind of think that the party has a long way to go to come up with the right nominee, the perfect nominee. Clearly that Hillary Clinton did not get the African-American support that Barack Obama did. She may have campaigned in Philadelphia and Milwaukee, but she didn't campaign in the rural areas. So there are a lot of parts of the coalition of the Democratic Party that need to coalesce behind a nominee if they're going to beat Trump. And even if they're leading, as you say, as Pam, as you point out, that in the polls, many of these Democrats are leading. The name of the game, as we learned in 2016, is the Electoral College. And while the Democrats are eating their own in these primaries and the debates, Trump is building up strong organizations in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, Florida, and North Carolina. So somehow, not only do you have to win the popular vote, you have to appeal to voters in these key states. You cannot take the black vote for granted, which the Democrats have been accused of doing for so long. But at the same time, you can't give up on the rural voters that will decide who wins in the Wisconsins and the Pennsylvanias of the world. By the way, was that all one sentence?
Yeah.
I just realized that was the longest sentence.
It's sort of Faulkner-ian in its way.
My God, Pam fell asleep a long time ago.
Not a bit. Brian in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, thanks.
My question is, of the current candidates that are for the Democratic side, which ones do you think would team up well for a president and a vice president? And I can take the answer off the air, so...
The reason I love that question so much is that vice presidents, except for maybe Lyndon Johnson in 1960, vice presidents don't mean anything. I mean, think of the excitement in 1984 when the Democrats picked Geraldine Ferraro. Oh, my God, the first woman ever. She's exciting in this. And Mondale Ferraro lost 49 out of 50 states to Ronald Reagan. So I'm not. And I think of Dan Quayle. What a doofus. What a, you know, the deer in the headlights. He's terrible. Meanwhile, Bush and Quayle won 40 out of 50 states. My only point is that VP doesn't really matter that much. But having said that, it's a lot of fun to speculate. And basically, I think you have to have, if you don't have a woman on the ticket in 2020 for the Democrats, you're making a big, big mistake, either leading the ticket or VP. And so the names are, you know, Biden and Klobuchar has been mentioned for a long time, but I think both candidates seemed to fade a bit last night, certainly in the debates. Jacobs in Georgia. Why am I forgetting her first name?
I wish I could help you.
The African American woman who barely lost the governorship in Georgia in 2018. She says she wants to be vice president. I don't think candidates should campaign for vice president, but you have people like Kamala Harris and Ms. Jacobs, and oh, please, somebody tell me.
I'm trying. I know, and I just heard her. She was just on NPR this morning,
and maybe Klobuchar. So those are possible vice presidential nominees. But some people said, well, what about Bernie Sanders? There was a thing online I saw about Bernie
Abrams.
Sanders.
Okay, go on. Stacey Abrams.
Stacey Abrams. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Sorry,
that's terrible.
I interrupted your thought, though.
No, but there were some people, there was a Bernie Sanders, who should Bernie Sanders pick as running mate? And they said Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Elizabeth Warren. It's great for the progressives, but that's about it. And maybe you'll win Massachusetts and Berkeley and somewhere in Eastern Europe. But I don't know if going far left for the Democrats is the answer to winning in November. I don't even know what the answer is. I didn't even know Stacey Abrams' first name, so you got the wrong guy to ask that question.
I just have a minute left, but I wanted to read this email from Tom, who writes, "The Democrats seem to be looking for someone with the youth of Buttigieg, the experience of Biden, the angry passion of Sanders, the intensity of Warren, the serenity of Klobuchar, and the ad company of Bloomberg." So there you go.
Why was I saying Jacobs when her name is Stacey Abrams?
I don't know. You really threw me off.
To me? You know, these Jewish names throw me off. No, I'm kidding, because she's an African-American woman.
Yes, she is. Oh, Ken. Well, for those of you who love Ken Rudin, he's going to be joining us a couple times a month. through the Ohio primary, at least, hopefully longer, and during this incredible year of politics. So, Ken Rudin, until next time, thank you so much.
And I heard rumors that I'm coming to Columbus in the next couple of months to see you.
Yes, there are rumors. We'll tell people more about that in a few months.
We'll save that. We'll save that, yes.
That's it. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's going to be...